The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Final show of the week. Hard to believe. Another fast-moving week. So much going on. Lots to get to on today's program. Later on in the show, we'll talk some about Stephen Hawking's death. He died on Wednesday. Quite an outpouring of response coming from commentators and celebrities and politicians all over the world. So we'll look more at that here in the next segment. On yesterday's show, we talked about those student protests also happening on Wednesday of this week. Students all across the United States just leaving their classrooms to protest against gun violence, to call for stricter gun laws. As I say, you can go back and listen to all of that commentary from yesterday's show. These podcasts, of course, are posted at the trumpet.com website. But following on that that protest, this story out of the Sacramento area in California, CBS Sacramento, it says a Rockland High School teacher is on paid administrative leave over her views that the national national school walkout. The teacher says that all she did was open up a debate about the politics of the protest in her classroom. She teaches history at Rockland High School. That's a suburb of Sacramento. And she brought up the debate. Is politics at play here? She says it was only appropriate to talk to her class about the politics of organized protests ahead of the school walkout. But, she said, the school disagreed with her views and told her to stay home Wednesday morning. She's on paid leave because she questioned whether or not it could be motivated by politics. This is education in California. What passes as education in California today? And, of course, you look at California. What is happening? This is like another nation. You think it's bad in the United States? All of this rebellion against the federal government. The Oakland mayor, who's basically warning illegal immigrants that ICE is coming after them, tipping them off, even the criminals, so that they won't be rounded up and caught and sent back. That's the mayor of Oakland. If you've been reading at the trumpet.com website in recent months, there's been quite a lot. California's the poverty capital of America. It's the leading state as far as poverty is concerned. And of course, there's a reason for that. Victor Davis Hanson covers it in a piece from, I think, about a month ago. He said, we dare not mention illegal immigration in California as a factor in the state's implosion, but privately, residents assume it has something to do with the 20% of the state's population that lives below the poverty level. 20%, one in five in California. Illegal immigration plays a role in the fact that one-third of the nation's welfare recipients lives in California, and that one in four state residents was not born in the United States. 25%. Or that one half of all immigrant households receive some sort of government assistance. That's astonishing. The poverty capital, the legalized marijuana capital, or leading state, certainly one of the leading states of that movement. We had a piece recently about San Francisco, one of the world's richest cities, now filthier than a third world slum. California's right at the forefront of the transgender movement, of the transgender indoctrination. And then all of the sanctuary cities. What is happening in California? President Trump was there just the other day. I think this was, what was it, Wednesday, you said? Tuesday, he went to California to look at the models for the wall that he's hoping to build. And listen to this. He's talking to a law enforcement official while they're holding up pictures of a wall that had been built years ago. It's not even the very best wall, but he's having this exchange with a policeman who's telling him just how much putting up anything made a difference to the communities on both sides of the wall, there in southern San Diego area, and even on the other side. I think he's commenting here more on the impact that it had on the United States or America's territory right there near the wall. Here's clip one.
When we put up the real wall, we're going to stop 99%, maybe more than that. But this is what it is now, with a not very good wall. But here it is before, and the people are just pouring across.
This is one of the sections where we have double fencing. You have a board, actually triple fencing. You have a wall here, you have bollards.
Right.
And again, it's outdated materials, but it proved the concept. But sir, the economic driver of this outlet mall that was built after we reestablished law and order in San Diego sector, and right behind that's over 500 brand new homes where people have felt so safe near the border, they've moved back in. But that's only because the U.S. Border Patrol reestablished law and order.
So they reestablished law and order in San Diego when they put up a wall. And it's not a superior wall, it's an inferior wall, but it's a wall. And you actually use the term reestablished law and order.
Yes, sir.
You hear it, folks. I mean, say what you want. This is life. These are the facts of life. That's incredible.
That is incredible that he actually used the term reestablished law and order. It's incredible that that could be considered controversial today, like I was saying yesterday, about just common sense. But no, it's controversial. I'm sure the Oakland mayor doesn't agree with that. I'm sure the people in charge of San Francisco or all the sanctuary cities, they hear law and order and think, oh, that's racist. That's insensitive. That's crazy. The people in California, they don't think the state officials, the local and city officials, they don't think much of the president of the United States. You can be sure about that. As he was having this exchange, by the way, he had a reporter speak up and say, well, what about Governor Jerry Brown, who's been quite critical of you and your policies? And here's how President Trump responded. Clip two.
Criticism from Governor Brown that some of this money might be better spent elsewhere.
Well, I think Governor Brown's done a very poor job running California. They have the highest taxes in the United States. The place is totally out of control. You have sanctuary cities where you have criminals living in the sanctuary cities. And then the mayor of Oakland goes out and notifies when ICE is going in to pick them up. And many of them were criminals with criminal records and very dangerous people. You would say dangerous people. And no, I think the governor's doing a terrible job running the state of California. And, you know, hey, I have property in California, I will say. I don't think too much about my property anymore, but I have great property in California. The taxes are way, way out of whack. And people are going to start to move pretty soon. And if you don't have safety, meaning if you don't have this kind of wall, the drugs are pouring through in California, can't do it. So the governor of California, nice guy, I think he's a nice guy, I knew him a long time ago, has not done the job. And the taxes are double and triple what they should be. And everybody that lives in California, they know it. Thank you very much, everybody.
That's President Trump's fairly harsh response to Governor Brown's criticism. Here's a state with taxes two and three times higher than it should be. Just an out of control state in so many ways. Lawlessness reigns. Drugs pouring across the border, illegal immigrants. It's not safe. It's not safe in so many of the cities there. And yet the leaders there locally, the leaders there in the state, they continue on. Victor Davis Hanson, in that piece I mentioned a bit ago, a record of nearly $30 billion a year is forecast to be sent this year as remittances home to Mexico. So they're pouring in, they make what they can, and send $30 billion back. It says, if the sum is assumed to be wired largely by the reported 11 million illegal aliens, then illegal immigrants are sending per capita around $2,700 per home per year. Again, in per capita terms, a household of five would average about 1,000 sent home per month to Mexico. A generosity impossible without the subsidies of the American taxpayer. And so many living there are on subsidies, as he's pointing out. And then that money's redirected to Mexico, family and friends in Mexico. They come to the United States of America for all of the many benefits, all of the social programs, all of the free handouts. And of course, Jerry Brown and others are happy to give it to them. So is the federal government, by the way. It says, in California, civilization is speeding in reverse. This is Victor Davis Hanson's take. He lives there. Well aside from the decrepit infrastructure, dismal public schools, and sky-high home prices, or rather, the state travels halfway in reverse. Anything involving the private sector, it says, smartphones, internet, new cars, TV, or getting solar panels installed is 21st century. Anything involving the overwhelmed government or public utilities, enforcing dumping laws, licensing dogs, hooking up solar panel meters to the grid, observing common traffic courtesies is early 20th century. I mean, it's just going in the opposite direction that it should be going in. You need to know why California is being cursed. We had an article on that as well not too long ago. California's curses. Look at all of the wildfires and the many other things happening. Now that's now routine. And then consider the movements, transgender and such, and the politics. Another article Richard pulled for me this morning. You think California politics is on the far left fringe right now? Well, wait until the next election. Wait until the next election. There's another story here from the San Francisco Chronicle, how that San Francisco is prepared to wipe out thousands of marijuana convictions. Wipe them off the books, that is. Hey, that's not really that's just a small little thing. That's just low-level drugs. And the push now is to legalize that all over the place so that everyone can be a pothead and feel good about it. That's California today, the golden state. What was it years ago? Or it was like the sick, if it was its own nation. And there's the push for that as well. They want to be their own. But remember that stat from years ago, if it was its own nation, it would be like the sixth most prosperous country in the world. Something like that. I'm just working from memory. But look at what's happened to all of the prosperity and the abundance. Look at the message that comes out of California cities that's coming out of that state. I mean, it's like the president said, look, these are the facts. These are the facts. Excuse me, you said law and order? We built this to restore law and order? Is that what you said? Yes, sir, that's what I said. And it's totally revolutionized that area along the border. People are moving back in there because they see, even though it's just a fence, it's nothing really that massive. Just a fence, and then all of a sudden people feel more secure, and they move back to those border areas. They build up malls. It's safer to not just have illegal immigrants just streaming across the border, across the nation. Common sense. It'll be interesting to see, again, how much progress is made on the wall. But he goes down there and, exposes some uncomfortable truths about California, about the cities in California, about the punishing high taxes. The thinking, though. Here's just a history teacher. She opens up the classroom. She opens it up for a debate. As is politics behind this? And she's on paid leave. Can't even, you can't even question it. The children are right. The children know. The children are clued in. They know all about the Second Amendment. They know all about America's history. You can't even question them. Who's in the position of teacher? Who's the administrator here? Well, she just opens it up for a debate, and now she's on paid leave. It's astonishing. Speaking of upside down, here's another piece in The Spectator, just to switch over to the UK here for a moment. We talked about the scandal in Rotherham, and then Rochdale as well. And the latest here in the UK, where is it? Telford. I'm not sure where that is, but it says here in The Spectator, whenever a Hollywood actress complains about some lecherous man, there's blanket coverage. Even our MPs feel the need to tut. So why, when there are allegations involving 1,000 underage girls abused by child grooming gangs in this country, does no one turn a hair? For the most part, the pedophile scandal in Telford was ignored by the people who should care most. See these radical leftists? These are the ones that are crying aloud when a celebrity comes and says, I was abused. I was padded wherever. But here you have teenage girls, white British teenagers, being raped multiple times a week. And no one speaks up, just like they didn't with Rochdale, just like they didn't, not in the media, just a few voices here and there. I mean, the Rotherham case, that was one, as I recall, either diligent reporter or politician, I forget which, who just stayed on the story until it finally was exposed for what it was. They don't want to get into it, though, because the ones doing the raping are Muslims. So you can't bring it up. You don't want to be called a racist. You don't want to be anti-Muslim. And so this sort of thing goes on. It says here, it's true, the news has always tended to focus on the interests and preoccupations of the powerful and well-connected, and Telford is a far cry from Westminster. But there's another reason why the story made no waves. The alleged perpetrators fit a pattern of offending, which was evident in the Rochdale and Rotherham scandals. They're predominantly Asian men targeting predominantly white girls, often in care, some terribly young. So it's barely even discussed. There's a Spectator piece here or there. How widespread is this? I mean, it's just one city after another in some of these Muslim communities. Systematic abuse. Further on, it says politicians seldom have problems condemning the activities of white racist groups. Rightly so, but rape and sexual assault need to be investigated and exposed. Whoever the perpetrators are, some politicians have agreed that the abuse discovered in Telford is merely an extension of the harassment of women in general. This is quite untrue. It's a highly specific cultural and criminal issue with its own discrete characteristics, a subject that keeps being dodged and, as a result, keeps coming back. The politicians keep dodging it. The news media, they keep dodging it. And so it keeps coming back again and again and again. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments, as always, to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
Oh, my God.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Freedom is one of the most sought-after ideals in human history. Man's search for freedom has taken him into the fiercest of protests, struggles, revolutions, civil wars, and even world wars. Today, in the midst of free societies, many continue to fight for what they perceive as ever greater freedoms. And yet, many of these same people are actively fighting against law. Few people understand that this war against law actually undermines true freedom. To learn more, request Gerald Flurry's booklet, No Freedom Without Law. In this free booklet, you will see what the Bible says about the latter-day spirit of rebellion and lawlessness that is now so common in our nations today. Also request America Under Attack. In this booklet, you will learn more about the spirit behind this attack on law. You'll see where this is leading. Both booklets are offered freely at no cost or obligation to you. Request No Freedom Without Law and America Under Attack. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
World-renowned physicist Stephen Hawking died on Wednesday in his home in Cambridge, England. He was 76 years old. And Hawking, as many people know, is most famous for his work in the field of cosmology, general relativity, quantum gravity, black holes. Born back in the 1940s, his mother was a medical research secretary. His father was a research biologist. And Stephen attended the University College in Oxford, studying physics and chemistry. And then went on from there to the university at Cambridge. And it was in his 20s, I believe it was, when he was diagnosed with a rare motor neuron disease, a disease where essentially his nerve cells were causing his muscles to shut down. Doctors back then just gave him a few years to live. Well, he lived quite a lot longer, but his illness did confine him to a wheelchair, and he was unable to speak except without a voice synthesizer. He wrote 15 books over the course of his life. The most popular by far was published in 1988, A Brief History of Time, sold over 10 million copies. And the reaction that the world had to his death, well, it was, I think, almost universally positive. Commentators just heaping all kinds of praise on him.
He was instantly recognizable and utterly remarkable. The visionary scientist, helpless in his high-tech wheelchair, who nonetheless transformed our view of the universe.
By any measure, Stephen Hawking's life was incredible. Even more so because in the 1960s, he was diagnosed with ALS, or motor neurone disease, and given just a few years to live.
This rare form of motor neuron disease left him virtually paralyzed, unable to express his profound vision of humanity and science without a voice synthesizer.
The world loses one of its greatest minds and most famous scientists. Stephen Hawking has died.
The rock star scientist sometimes worked here and also gave speeches. And tonight we're taking a look back at his brilliant mind and humor.
Hawking studied the mysteries of space and time, topics few understand, yet he was known worldwide for his brilliant mind and the body that betrayed him.
CNN said he was considered to be one of the world's greatest, considered by many, actually, to be the world's greatest living scientist. You heard the word brilliant over and again in that montage. Rock star celebrity. Roger Penrose at The Guardian, he said, the brightest star in the firmament of science, whose insights shaped modern cosmology and inspired global audiences in the millions. I mean, he inspired millions of people, Stephen Hawking. Another commentator on Twitter said that his passing has left an intellectual vacuum in his wake. That's from an astrophysicist. Politicians weighed in. The Indian Prime Minister, he said Professor Stephen Hawking was an outstanding scientist and academic. His grit and tenacity inspired people all over the world. His demise is anguishing. Professor Hawking's pioneering work made our world a better place, he said. UK Prime Minister Theresa May, she said, Hawking was a brilliant and extraordinary mind, one of the great scientists of his generation. His courage, humor, and determination to get the most from life was an inspiration. His legacy will not be forgotten. Well, certainly the way that he pushed himself in the scientific community with the disadvantages he had physically, that is a remarkable side to this story for sure. But did he really make the world a better place? And how brilliant was he in actual fact? British astronaut Tim Peake, he said he inspired generations to look beyond our own blue planet and expand our understanding of the universe. Did he really expand our understanding of the universe? His personality and genius will be sorely missed. Jeremy Corbyn weighed in, the Labour leader here in the UK. Stephen Hawking inspired the world with his determination to explain the mysteries of the cosmos. But he also showed breathtaking courage to overcome life's adversities and a burning passion to protect our National Health Service. That's Jeremy Corbyn. Hawking was a big fan of the NHS, I guess. Corbyn's had a rough week, by the way. Going soft on Russia. Here, Putin's assassinating people in London right and left. And Corbyn's coming forward saying, hey, we don't want to overreact. We don't want a confrontation with Russia. Just let Putin keep killing us. Anyway, that's a little bit of an aside. He's taken quite a beating in some of the conservative media here. But here is a scientist, Stephen Hawking, who inspired millions, who inspired generations, who supposedly opened our understanding to the universe. I forget how many years ago this was. This is Hawking speaking through his voice synthesizer and explaining some of his brilliant conclusions regarding the universe. Here's clip 8.
The universe can spontaneously create itself out of nothing.
The universe can spontaneously create itself out of nothing. There's a creator. It's the universe. It created itself. It came from nothing. What does God say about that kind of reasoning? What does the Bible say about individuals who conclude that the universe sprung into existence without a great creator God creating it? Another clip from that same speech, clip 9.
Are we alone, or is there other life in the universe? We believe that life arose spontaneously on the Earth, so it must be possible for life to appear on other suitable planets, of which there seem to be a large number in the galaxy. But we don't know how life first appeared.
The universe created itself, and then life rose spontaneously on the Earth, he says. And what God says, this is the truth of the Bible. This is God's position. This is God's take. He says, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. That's what the fool says. That same psalm, Psalm 14, the Lord looks down from heaven upon the children of men to see if there were any that did understand and seek God. They are all gone aside, God says. They are all together become filthy. There's none that does good. No, not one of them. Not even one of them. It's not just Stephen Hawking we're talking about here. This is God's assessment of man's so-called progress. Look at the world. Look at California. Look at the UK. As I covered in the first segment, has Stephen Hawking or anyone in the world of science, philosophy, have they really made this world a better place? Paul Johnson, Ron Fraser referred to this back in an article in 2005 at thetrumpet.com. But he referred to a piece by Paul Johnson, the British historian, who was writing about an interview in which Stephen Hawking was asked the question, what existed before the universe began? Okay, you have your conclusions about the universe, how it came to be, but what existed before the universe? And Hawking's reply was, well, that's a meaningless question. Don't even ask that question. No, that's a purposeless question. There's no sense in even asking it. And Paul Johnson said, oh, no, it isn't. That's not a meaningless question. Johnson wrote, no question is meaningless if it's prompted by a genuine thirst for knowledge. I mean, isn't this what Stephen Hawking was supposedly in pursuit of his whole life? A genuine thirst for knowledge. Well, what about the time before the universe? Paul Johnson wrote, physicists expect us to believe their claim that not merely something, but everything was created out of nothing, thus breaking the fundamental law of physics. I mean, it breaks their own fundamental law that something was created out of nothing. Paul Johnson said, they fear that trying to answer questions like the one that was posed, what existed before the universe? They fear that trying to answer questions like that, or admitting that they are meaningful questions, will involve them in a debate about the three-letter word, which to them is the final obscenity, G-O-D. It's not even a subject to be brought up in the debate. It's so far out. It's so outlandish. It's comical. It's crazy. It's for the lunatic fringe. Hawking said in his famous book, A Brief History of Time, he said, our solar system is certainly a prerequisite for our existence. But there does not seem to be any need for all these other galaxies. So that pretty much sums up human reasoning about the universe. If it doesn't make sense to us, then there's no real sense to it. Or if we don't really know the question or the answer, rather, just say it's a meaningless question. Just brush it aside. Just cast it aside. This is the most brilliant mind of our time, we're told. Where is the humility? How does humility even factor into a true education, anyway? The Bible, of course, has a very thorough and detailed explanation for the universe, its origin, even what happened before the universe came into existence, before God brought it into existence. You think of some of the most inspiring Bible passages. Well, I'll come to that in just a second. Let me just to contrast the scientists of old with the one that we heard about this past week. This is from a 2004 video called The Privileged Planet. And here is the narrator in one case and then some commentators. I won't list off all their names. But in this clip, they're just talking about the founders of modern science. Here's clip three.
In his search for a more elegant description of the solar system, Nicholas Copernicus was motivated by his desire to comprehend what he called the mechanism of the universe, wrought for us by a supremely good and orderly creator. The system, the best and most orderly artist of all, framed for our sake.
And so he imagined this analogy of a workman, a craftsman, making something that worked well and was beautiful. And that analogy, it wasn't one of his conclusions, that analogy was one of his assumptions.
The founders of modern science, like Copernicus and Kepler and Galileo and Newton himself, believed that the universe was the product of a mind, that it was intelligible to beings like ourselves because the universe itself was the product of an intelligent being.
They were driven by this notion that this was essentially a theological quest. They were uncovering God's handiwork in the way the world worked. I mean, what a thought that we can glimpse the mind of God. We can actually figure out how God put the universe together. There's a hidden subtext in nature which can be exposed through this procedure we call science.
These founders, they were driven by this quest. Copernicus, Kepler, Galileo, Newton. They thought, well, to get a glimpse of the mind of God. I mean, to try to, I'm not saying they had all the answers. They didn't have God's revelation. But they at least believed in God. They at least believed in a creator God. But where are the most prominent minds today with respect to God, with respect to the God question, with respect to the question about what was it before the universe? You say it came into existence on its own. You say it created itself. What about before the universe? Oh, well, that's a meaningless question. The Wall Street Journal article, I'll probably get into this more next week. It was, I think, from about a month ago, if I can find the title here. My notes are a little bit out of order right now. But in any event, it's talking about just how perfect the Earth and our solar system are for human life. And this is a point that Joel Hilliker makes in the Universe booklet that we have at thetrumpet.com. But to quote from the Wall Street Journal, it says, as factors continued to be discovered, the number of possible planets hit zero and kept going. In other words, the odds turned against any planet in the universe supporting life, including this one. Probability said that even we shouldn't be here. Today, there are more than 200 known parameters. I picked it up in the middle of a thought, but here it is today. 200 known parameters necessary for a planet to support life, every single one of which must be perfectly met or the whole thing falls apart. This is the Wall Street Journal. It's actually not recent. It's 2014. Well, fairly recent. A few years ago, science increasingly makes the case for God. Eric Metaxas wrote, let me just back up since I picked it up into the middle of the paragraph, but it says, in 1966, Time magazine ran a cover story asking, is God dead? Many have accepted the cultural narrative that he's obsolete, that as science progresses, there is less need for God to explain the universe. Yet, it turns out that the rumors of God's death were premature. More amazing is that the relatively recent case for his existence comes from a surprising place, science itself. I mean, the more sophisticated and advanced we are with the technology, look at the Hubble telescope and some of these other advancements. It makes it that, for anyone that's paying attention or that's just opening his eyes to the truth, it just proves God's existence more easily. 200 known parameters necessary for a planet to support life, and every single one of which must be perfectly met or the whole thing falls apart. It says without a massive planet like Jupiter nearby, whose gravity will draw away asteroids, a thousand times as many would hit Earth's surface. And that's just one. That's just one in this video from a few years ago, Privileged Planet. I mean, it goes through and talks about all of these other just perfect. Joe Hilliker in the booklet talks about it being the Goldilocks planet. Because everything's set just perfectly for it to sustain human life. Here's clip number 4.
We orbit what is known as a spectral type G2 dwarf main sequence star. It is well suited for our needs. If the sun were less massive, like 90% of the stars in the galaxy, the habitable zone would be smaller. To remain within its boundaries, the Earth would have to be positioned closer to its star. Here, increased gravity would lock our planet's rotation into synchronization with its orbit. While one side of the Earth continually faced the sun and increased radiation from solar flares, the dark side of the planet would lay shrouded in perpetual cold and ice. It is unlikely complex life could tolerate these drastic extremes in temperature.
So it's right at the perfect distance. We have the perfect star in our sun. This article, this is actually from a National Geographic piece. One strange rock, 6 things that make life on Earth possible. I don't know if these authors believe in God or not, but they're pointing out 6 things that just make life here on this planet possible. We're at just the right distance from the sun. We have this this stable and long-lasting star. Our location is far from many hazards. You know, and on it goes. Some of the same points as brought out in this video. Let me just play you one more clip, clip 5.
It is now widely recognized that the chemical properties of water are exquisitely suited for carbon-based life. These properties include water's ability to dissolve and transport the chemical nutrients vital to all living organisms, and its unmatched capacity to absorb heat from the sun, a process critical for regulating the Earth's surface temperature. In liquid form, water is an extraordinary substance, and its existence hinges upon another factor essential to complex life, a planet's distance from its home star.
It's like what they say in real estate, location, location, location. A habitable planet lives in what we call the Goldilocks zone. It's not too hot, it's not too cold, it's just right. And when I say just right, I mean just right for water.
Liquid water really helps define the habitable zone. If it's too hot, again, the water just boils away. You just can't get condensed water. It's too cold, as in Mars today, it freezes out.
Within our solar system, the habitable zone is relatively narrow, beginning well outside the orbit of Venus and ending short of the orbit of Mars. If the Earth were just 5% closer to the sun, it would be subject to the same fate as Venus. A runaway greenhouse effect with temperatures rising to nearly 900 degrees Fahrenheit. Conversely, if the Earth were 20% farther from its home star, carbon dioxide clouds would form in its upper atmosphere, initiating the cycle of ice and cold that has sterilized Mars.
In other words, we're just at the perfect location, even to the point where we can see the universe like we do. There's verses in the Bible that talk about us lifting up our eyes to look at the heavens. To look at the heavens. That's what David did. Psalm 8, David just marveled at the creation of God. He looked at the universe, the massive, immense size of the universe, and he said, "What is man that God, that you should even be mindful of us, that you should care about us?" And David went on to say, "Boy, you've given us all this dominion over this earth." And then in Hebrews 2, the Apostle Paul said that that dominion is to extend out into the universe. The entire universe. Paul paraphrased what David said in that psalm. And he said, "You have put all things in subjection under his feet." That's referring to human beings. "For in that he," God, "put all in subjection under him," man, "he," that's God, "left nothing that is not put under him." And you look into the Moffat version of that passage, and it says the universe. Instead of all things, it says the universe. That's to come under the jurisdiction of human beings. The God family. The entire universe, all the galaxies and the countless suns and planets, everything. Everything that's out there. Paul says in the same verse, verse 8 of Hebrews 2, "But now we see not yet all things put under him." I mean, we don't see it yet, but soon we will. What a glorious, glorious purpose and plan. And even in just looking out into the universe, even in just looking at this earth, Romans 1, verse 19, it says, "For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. Ever since the creation of the world, his invisible nature, namely his eternal power and deity, has been clearly perceived in the things that have been made." That's the physical creation, the material creation. And then Paul says in verse 20, "So they are without excuse." Creation is proof of God's existence. Creation demands a creator. God's nature, his, even his purpose, it's clearly revealed in the physical creation, in the universe. As it says in Psalm 19:1, "The heavens declare God's glory." God has shown us, and we are without excuse if we reject his existence, his authority over our lives. We reduce ourselves to fools if we reject his existence, if we say that he doesn't exist. Look around. Open your eyes, God says. The entire vast, limitless universe, the way that this earth on which we dwell is perfectly situated, all the living creatures that God has produced, the fact that they all reproduce after their own kind, the fact that life comes from life, the law of biogenesis, it's all explained. Starting right there in the first chapter of the Bible. Mr. Armstrong, Herbert Armstrong, said in his booklet, "Does God Exist?" The wisest of the ancients did not know what science makes available today. Thus, it is demonstrated today that life comes only from life, and that each kind produces only after its kind. It's exactly the way God said that it would be. Moses wrote about that thousands and thousands of years ago. It reveals so much about God and his plan. Romans 1, continuing in verse 21. I mean, here's what's wrong with the most highly esteemed scientists of our day. Verse 21, because that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were they thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. I mean, their heart went dark. Their minds went dark. Because they didn't glorify God. They weren't thankful to God. They lacked humility. That's pretty amazing, the contrast. Copernicus, all these founding fathers, Kepler, Galileo, Newton, they were motivated, they were driven by this notion that this was essentially a theological quest. This was a quest to understand the mind of God, to get a glimpse of God's purpose and plan. This is what motivated the scientists of old. Not so today. Well, there may be a few, like in that video and in that Wall Street Journal piece that I quoted from a moment ago. But they're certainly not going to be lauded as the most brilliant mind of our day when they die. That would be reserved for Stephen Hawking. It's pretty amazing. God says in 2 Peter 3 that scoffers would come in the last days, just scoffing at the Bible, scoffing at Bible prophecy, scoffing at God's existence. It says for this they willingly are ignorant of, that by the word of God the heavens were of old and the earth standing out of water and in the water. They just reject all of the miracles of God, all of the history in the Bible, anything about the flood of Noah's day or Sodom and Gomorrah. It's all rejected because we want nothing to do with a great creator God who reigns over his creation, who reigns supreme, and who says to us, now you obey these laws, just like you see these laws that keep everything just perfectly in place, the laws of physics. Here's what I have to teach you about a great spiritual law that will keep your lives in order, that will help you in your relationship with each other, that will help you to establish a relationship with me as your creator. Because, like I covered with you yesterday, because God wants us to be right in his bosom, right in the bosom of the Father, declaring the Father's greatness, upholding and promoting the Father. It's like I was saying in class earlier today, you see the curse of fatherlessness all across our society. The scourge. It's an epidemic. And there might be a few still in conservative religious circles that would come forward and really try to speak up and defend the Father. But then you look at the world of traditional Christianity, and truthfully, I mean, how much have they really defended the role of God the Father? They've pushed him out. They've pushed him out of their religion. So many of those Laodicean Christians that turned away from God's truth, they came along in the 1990s, of course, after Mr. Armstrong died, and started to systematically change all of the doctrines, liberalize everything, and say that, hey, now the focus is on Jesus Christ. The focus is on Christ. It's not on the Father. Where did Christ put the focus? What message did Jesus proclaim? If you open your eyes to the truth of the Bible, if you open your eyes to the universe and God's creation, it reveals God the Father right at the center of it all. He's right in the middle. God the Father, the great creator God, the family man, reproducing himself, and we have Jesus Christ as his son. He's our pioneer. that same passage in Hebrews 2 brings out, he leads us right to the Father's throne, which is in this great, vast, limitless universe, the third heaven. And that's where God wants to take you and me. I mean, you talk about a universe vision. Like I say, the Bible is not in any way unclear about why the universe. I would just encourage you to pull that universe booklet off the shelf, Joel Hilliker's piece. It's got a number of breathtaking pictures in there as well, but some powerful, powerful reading, a wonderful message of hope that this world really does need, particularly now if their minds are on science, if their minds are on physicists. This would be a good time to go through Hebrews 2 and Psalm 8 and Romans 8. I didn't even get to that yet. But we'll have to get into some of this more at a later time. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to send in some comments in response to this show or any other, you can send them to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today and all week. We'll see you next week.